Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Dr. Pettis Perry. Today I'm missing my co-host, Jill Cody, to whom I say I love you, my friend, and look forward to co-hosting our next show together. But until then, I hope you all will stick around for the next hour because we do have a very special friend of the show as our interview guest today. Before I introduce him, I want to say that America is at a tipping point. One political party believes in democracy, and the other has become a major anti-democratic force right before our eyes. And that's why it is so hard to believe that the Republican leadership, the RNC, congressional members, as well as governors, have a ruthless plan underway to subvert our constitutional democracy. This is not hyperbole. I'm particularly saddened and upset that today, on the 77th anniversary of D-Day, we're talking about our nation struggling to once again fight fascism, which is raising its ugly head not only here in the United States, backed by the full-throated support of the Republican Party, but also elsewhere in places like Europe and the Middle East, including places like Israel, where the right-wing government is actively and openly working towards the wanton eradication of the Palestinian people from their homelands using the same sorts of practices Nazi Germany used throughout Europe to dislodge and then exterminate the Jewish people. When will we learn? The evidence is clear. Abandonment of our democracy can and is happening here. We must realize it now so that we can work collectively to stop it. Our future depends on it. Our program today is Democracy Abandoned, and our very special guest is the former governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman. I'll be speaking with Governor Siegelman about our democracy being abandoned in favor of embracing neo-fascist authoritarian tyranny and denialism for the January 6th attack that, had it been successful, would have ended our democracy. That our democracy is being abandoned by one party to embrace laws restricting the right to vote and exercise peacefully through protests, which are foundational to sustaining our democracy. We'll also talk about democracy being abandoned for the big lie and democracy being abandoned for anti-truth, anti-fact-based cult. We have big things to do. Former Governor Don Siegelman is the author of Stealing Our Democracy: How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. It has become a hot top five best book listed on the National Book Review and now may be heard on Audible. It is an excellent read that I highly recommend if you want to more fully understand how the political and legal forces in our country have set the stage for authoritarianism and fascism. Governor Don Siegelman is the only politician in Alabama history to hold all of the state's top constitutional offices, including governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, before becoming America's number one political prisoner because he planned to challenge George W. Bush for the presidency. In addition, Governor Siegelman's case was the subject of a CBS 60 Minutes report and a full-length documentary titled Atticus V. the Architect. If you have not yet seen it, I encourage you to also find it on your favorite streaming service and watch it. Between the governor's book and the 60 Minutes report, I think you will find all of what you need to know about how our government can use its power to silence its opposition. If you think it can't happen, 34 states have already introduced 81 pieces of legislation to make it illegal to peacefully protest. Coupled with the governor's story and taken as a whole, they clearly illustrate how close we are to losing our democracy and becoming a fascist state. Welcome back to Be Bold America, Governor Siegelman. It is such an honor to speak with you again.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Perry. It's good to be here, and I want to take this opportunity to wish Jill Cody my best, our best, our collective best, and look forward to having her back on soon as well. But I'm
thank
glad to
that.
Be with you tonight. Great topic.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be speaking with you about the subject matter tonight. I think you will be able to provide some unique insights as we go through the conversation. So I tell you what, let's begin with this. In an October 2020 CBS report, Leslie Gornstein defined fascism as a political movement that embraces far-right nationalism and the forceful suppression of any opposition, all overseen by an authoritarian government. In the spirit of the 77th anniversary of D-Day, which is today, and the more than 500,000 service members of our combat forces who have made the ultimate sacrifice during World War II, what are your thoughts about what we learned in the aftermath of fighting the Nazis and the potential for us to become a fascist state here in the U.S. if we do not stop what is happening politically with the Republican Party's efforts to deny democracy for its primarily non-white citizens, but also who stand up for those who stand up for democracy, as your case well illustrates. Am I right to raise the alarm from DEFCON 3 to DEFCON 4 that we are rapidly moving towards fascism? What are your thoughts?
Well, Dr. Perry, I think what we should have learned through history is that it's already happening in America. I want to, of course, not just talk about my situation, but, you know, I was a sitting governor. I defeated a Republican incumbent who was, and then Karl Rove's client, the state attorney general, started an investigation. It was kicked into high gear by a person Karl Rove had vetted and Bush had appointed as a U.S. attorney. While I was being investigated by the U.S. attorney, your husband, who was Karl Rove's business partner in Alabama, was running my opponent's campaign. So I was being investigated by a United States attorney whose husband was running my opponent's campaign, brought to trial 1 month before my reelection by a judge with whom I'd had multiple run-ins. Anyway, the long and short is that if politics is such that the Department of Justice can be politicized and used as a weapon against the other party to suppress them, to silence them, to put them in prison, then I think we probably have already taken a step across the line toward fascism. And, you know, to reiterate what you were saying at the beginning of the program, the Republican Party has now fallen in lockstep behind Donald Trump, adopting his rhetoric, his lies about the election. They still don't even admit that Biden, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won the election fair and square. And they're marching on in this effort, as you said, to suppress democracy by limiting the right to vote. And what's so shocking is that the Republicans, virtually all of them, are in line with that, and state after state has passed laws or in the process of passing laws that would limit a person's right to vote. You know what baffles me, and I'll say this and then be quiet. You know, if a person is qualified to vote, what difference does it make whether they stand in line for hours on election day to cast a ballot, or they drive by a mailbox and put it in a drop box, put their ballot in a drop box, or send it in, or vote, have an early voting, and they vote early. You know, it doesn't matter as long as people only vote one time. It does. The method of voting should not matter. But Republicans want to cut off this opportunity for people to vote early, to vote by mail, to use drop boxes, because they know that most of those people favor Democrats. And a lot of these folks are people who work for a living, who work from, you know, 7 to 6 at night or something, and simply cannot afford to stand in line all day. So they have to depend on other methods to vote. But the Republicans want to suppress the vote of working families because they know that working families generally support Democrats.
Yeah, we're seeing that all over the country as these new laws are being passed and the craziness that's going on with the audits after the fact. So we'll talk a little bit more, hopefully, about that later. But as someone who teaches leadership studies and human behavior, I know things don't happen in isolation. And as the quantum physicists have proved, all things in nature are connected. So what connections do you see, if any, between the exercise of power politics, the law, and how institutions protect themselves?
Well, I think that, you know, institutions like the Department of Justice protects itself by refusing to investigate the misconduct of prosecutors or perhaps judges. And it reminds me of the of what we're facing now with ending this ending police violence against people of color, African Americans, blacks, and you know, we have seen it over and over again of police, you know, murdering someone because they think he's cashing a counterfeit $20 bill, or killing a black child on the street because he has a toy gun, or shooting a black man in the back as he's running away from a policeman, or killing someone because he was parking and went to sleep in a drive-through at a restaurant. You know, if we want to, we've got to begin to hold police accountable for their actions if we want to end this part of the systemic racism. If we want to attack this part of privilege, then we've got to end police privilege, and we do that by holding them accountable. Prosecutors get 99% of the indictments they want. They get 99% of the indictments they want to get. But yet, when it comes to holding police accountable for murdering a black man or woman, that percentage drops precipitously. And prosecutors are able to manipulate the outcome of a grand jury for a couple of reasons. One, it's a secret proceeding. It's a private proceeding. There's no one there as a check on truth. There's no judge and no lawyer for the family of the victim. And prosecutors have a free hand, as the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, Alex Krasinski, said some years ago, that prosecutors withholding exculpatory evidence is an epidemic in America. Prosecutors can withhold evidence that they don't want grand jurors or juries to know about, and they can present false evidence or false testimony with impunity because they cannot be sued civilly. And that they were given immunity in a 1976 case in the United States Supreme Court. And as evidence of that, on January the 4th, 2010, during President Obama's administration, Elena Kagan, when she was Solicitor General, argued to the United States Supreme Court, or had her deputy argue, that U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. United States citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. An unfortunate statement, but it happens to be true. The law supports that. So we've got to end the qualified immunity for police and end the immunity for prosecutors, and we need to provide a lawyer for family members of blacks who are killed by police. Lawyers need to be, a lawyer for the family needs to be present in the grand jury as a check on truth. To hold that part of our justice system accountable.
Yeah, I was blown away when I came across that part in your book. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, Many Voices, One Station. In addition, if you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America to 222-828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. I am your host, Pettis Perry.
KSQD thanks attorney Ned Hearn for supporting this program. Ned Hearn specializes in intellectual property and business law with a focus on entertainment, internet, and computer software business and their convergence, intersecting content, media, and technology in the digital environment. More info at www.internetmedialaw.com. Thank you, Ned Hearn, for supporting KSQD 90.7 FM.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Todd Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
Our topic of discussion today is Democracy Abandoned, with former governor of Alabama Don Siegelman, author of Stealing Our Democracy, that may now be heard on Audible. And you may learn more about the governor by visiting his website at donsiegelman.org. Let's shift for a moment, Governor. Let's talk about how Trump's false claims, delusional prophecies about being reinstated as president and his other corrupt acts brought the Republican Party and America to the brink of abandoning democracy for the sake of political power, if nothing else, and his personal gain. What is their end game?
Their end game is money and power. I think for the for most of the people in the United States Senate, I don't think that they are openly corrupt for the purpose of simply making money, although I do think that exists, and certainly it exists with respect to Donald Trump. He spent a good deal of his life, corrupting the democratic process through bribes to local candidates as a businessman, and of course, as president, his abuse of power and using the Department of Justice as a shield to shield himself from investigations and as a weapon to go after his opponents, to protect himself from bribing the president of Ukraine. So I think their end game is simply, for the most part, power. They want control. And they want to be able to decide, it's life or death issues, for one, if you're looking at the state of our criminal justice system. And it's freedom versus, going to jail for people like Donald Trump, who should have been held accountable during the impeachment trial. The Republicans should have convicted him for his abuse of power and his open bribe of the president of Ukraine. And because they did not, it opened the door for him to raise a bunch of money and get ready to run for re-election. And now he's sitting pretty to continue his efforts to raise money and spread lies and to threaten the foundation of our democracy. I don't think they care about our democracy. They care, or seemingly so, they care about power.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. As we think about Trump and what he's done for and to our country. Other than Trump himself, what do you feel were the real issues that led to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris being elected?
Well, I don't think that the election was about Donald Trump. Yes, Trump played a big, big part in it because he insisted on it. But I think people understood that that there's something wrong when three families have 50% of the wealth, the top 1% have 92%, when large corporations pay nothing in taxes while working families struggle to make ends meet and to pay their fair share of taxes. You know, they see it. I think they see it when they look at the salaries of CEOs. I saw the other day that the CEO of McDonald's makes over $10 million a year, where workers, the average worker, makes about $9,100 a year. But the American people, I think, voted for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris because they're concerned about their children and their children's future, and they understand that it starts with education. They want their children to have a better life than they had. They want their parents and grandparents to be able to live out the rest of their lives without having to worry about food or drugs or a place to live. When Biden and Kamala Harris talked about having access to preschool, free early learning, and providing free college education or free higher education or job training for every high school graduate, when they talked about ending student loans to lift the burden off those young people so they could get on with their lives and add to the economy, that all helped push people toward the Democratic ticket. The people of America, I think, understand understood that we had to have a president who was going to correct our unjust tax system. We had to have a president who was going to fight for more and better jobs, who would put practices into place that would create new uses for renewable energy, putting more people to work, who would push forward with an infrastructure bill for not only better roads and fast rail, but also clean air and clean water, and using new and renewable energy. They wanted a president, and it wasn't Donald Trump, who would be a role model for their children, who would be civil and couth, someone who would respect the rights of women and would respect women, would support the right of a free press and understand its relationship to the preservation of our democracy. I think they wanted a president who would fight for equal justice, social justice, racial justice, environmental justice, and they wanted a president who would work for criminal justice reform. They understand that something is wrong when we have 2 million people incarcerated in America at a cost of some $200 billion a year. Many of these people, most of them, enter prison without having life skills or job skills, and they leave the exact same way. So I think all of those things taken together played a significant role in moving people toward the Democratic ticket and away from Donald Trump.
What do you think Joe Biden needs to do to fulfill his campaign promises to save the soul of our democracy?
Well, half measures. In fact, I think it was Tom Hartman who said half measures will destroy people's faith and destroy the Democratic Party's chances of making life better for working families. Half measures will not win back or keep the working families from drifting away from the Democratic Party. He has to go big. He has to be bold. I believe we're going to have to end the filibuster. Otherwise, we leave Mitch McConnell and Joe Manchin in control of the Joe Biden agenda. I just don't see a way to compromise with people who are hell-bent on destroying our democracy.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. As I look at what's happening, particularly with Manchin holding things up because of some idea that he's going to get some Republicans to join into this effort. We'll see what happens as we go forward. You know, as I think about the situation with Kamala and Biden being elected, what do you think would have been different had the Republicans supported impeachment and removed Trump from office while he was in office?
Well, I think we would have been spared what we're going through now. It would have prevented many of the lies and misinformation and conspiracy theories that have resulted in pitting Americans against Americans. They have deliberately tried to polarize the people by minimizing immigrants and Muslims and blacks and Asians and Mexicans, and you know, it goes on and on. But we would have been spared to a great extent the corruption of the Department of Justice or the Department of Defense. It was the Defense Department's the Secretary of Defense, Chris Miller, who prevented the National Guard from helping the Capitol Police on January the 6th. And we would have been spared January the 6th. We would have been spared the insurrection. So there's a lot that would not have happened had the Republican Party, the Republican Senate, just followed the law. It was absolutely clear from the from recorded conversations and from witnesses that President Trump tried to bribe the president of Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and was going to bargain with the president of Ukraine with money that had already been appropriated by Congress. This wasn't a close call. This wasn't something that, you know, people had to ponder. It was an out-and-out bribe, and it was an abuse of power. He should have been convicted, and if he had been convicted, we would have been dealing with a different situation altogether.
Yeah, I wonder whether it might have also led to another Republican president had those things occurred. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally, online through our KSQD.org website. If you have ideas for the show, you may reach out to me or Jill by emailing info@KSQD.org. I'm your host, Dr. Pettus Perry.
It's deja vu all over again. The landmark album by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young was released 50 years ago, and there's a new anniversary edition. You can be one of the 10 lucky K-Squid listeners to win the MP3 version of the package with 48 versions of the songs from Deja Vu. The contest runs June 10th through June 20th. To win, tune into K-Squid 90.7 FM or KSQD.org.
Now back to our bold and impressive guest, former Governor Don Siegelman. Our topic, Democracy Abandoned. You know, Governor, as I was going through your book, I was stunned by some of the things that you spoke about already with Justice Kagan and the issues of qualified immunity and prosecutorial impunity, and the changes that you suggested for the grand jury. I was also amazed that a person testifying on their own behalf can receive additional prison time for perjury if they're found guilty. How does that work?
Well, it's amazing what federal judges can do. Judges at sentencing can have a great deal of freedom to do whatever they want to do. For example, when I was sentenced, the judge tripled my guideline range by including charges for which the jury found me innocent. In other words, you can be sentenced to prison for additional years based on matters for which the jury found you not guilty, for acquitted conduct. Judges can also add years and do frequently add years to a prison sentence for what they call relevant conduct. In other words, if you get arrested when you're 17 for marijuana, it's a felony, but you get put on probation. You get arrested at 19 for marijuana, a felony, you're put on probation. Then you get arrested at 23 for a small amount of crack cocaine. It's a felony. And then they say, well, you know what? We're going to career you out. We're going to give you 25 years in prison. And then they, you know, if the guy testifies on his own behalf, or a woman testifies on her own behalf, and the jury finds him guilty anyway, the judge says, well, you must have lied, you must have committed perjury, or you were trying to obstruct justice by trying to mislead the jury, because obviously you were lying because the jury found you guilty. So they add additional years in prison for perjury, obstruction of justice. It makes absolutely no sense. And, of course, it violates the principle of a trial by jury. You know, one other point I'd like to make on this same subject is that in Alabama, we had something that allowed judges to override a jury's decision of life in prison. So a jury would return a verdict for a defendant of life in prison, maybe without parole, or with parole, doesn't matter, the judge could override the jury and impose the death sentence. The Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama studied this and found that in an election year, the overrides of judges from life in prison to a death sentence rose from 7% to 30% in an election year. Why is that, do you think? It's because judges in Alabama are elected, and they want to be seen as tough on crime. Now, if that doesn't make you sick at your stomach, if you don't shake your head and say, my God, this is horrible, this is wrong, then you know, you've already crossed the line into fascism as well. You know, fortunately, that law was repealed and judges can no longer do that in Alabama, but that was up until just a few years ago.
So that's amazing. And it does make me sick to my stomach.
Let me mention this one other fact. You know, the fact that we've had well over 1,500 exonerations of people in prison over the last 20 years, and well over 150 of those have been men and women on death row. They were exonerated because prosecutors had engaged in misconduct. They had either lied to a grand jury or lied to a jury or presented false evidence. You know, many times a young felon is caught and prosecutors will make him a deal saying, okay, if you will help us convict this other person, we will cut you a deal. In fact, we will recommend no time in prison for you altogether if you will help us convict this other person. And a person looking at maybe 40 years in prison versus no time in prison, you know, maybe has a bit of a twinge of conscience, but ultimately says, I'll help you out, Mr. Prosecutor. I'll lie for you. And so, in fact, that's exactly what happened in my case. They found a young felon who was facing decades in prison and offered him a deal he couldn't refuse. They offered him no time in prison if he, Nick Bailey, would help convict me, the governor of the state of Alabama. And he did, and it was successful. They recommended no time in prison. The judge sentenced him to less than a year, and he was out in about 8 months. But that's my story.
Yeah, you have a powerful story, Governor. I'm just amazed as I went through your book and, you know, learned so much more about what happened to you. You have a very unique perspective because you're an attorney. You were the attorney general and held other offices, obviously. But it gives you a unique insight, I think, into the justice system, how it works and what might need to change. So if you had the power, what would you do to improve the American justice system?
It would be easy, but that's an easy answer. But it takes the President of the United States can make changes today. President Biden can appoint a director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons who will change the perspective of prisons from one of simply incarceration to one of rehabilitation. He can change from the motivation of the guards from one of punishment to reducing recidivism. They can offer promotions based on the reduction of recidivism and begin to change the mindset of how our prisons operate. Prisoners should not go into prison without job skills and leave the same way. Yet that is the standard operating procedure in every prison in this country. It is designed to punish people, not rehabilitate them or prepare them to succeed on their own when they get out of prison. The second thing the President of the United States could do is to appoint a pardons attorney who will actually recommend pardons for people who've gotten screwed by the system. People who, you brought this up about testifying their own on their own behalf and then getting a second, you know, maybe 4 to 10 years added because the judge said, well, you must have committed perjury because the jury convicted you anyway. You know, a pardon attorney, a pardons person looking at pardons or commutations of sentences should look at all of those cases. And anybody that has been sentenced improperly by a judge in violation of the Sixth Amendment's right to a trial by jury should have their sentence reduced. But, you know, go back to Bill Barr. Right at the beginning of COVID, he sent out a memo to all of the wardens in the country saying, you know, if somebody is in for a nonviolent crime, if they are not a threat to society, if they have no safety risk to releasing them, then get them out of prison. Well, my point would be, well, if it was okay to release them because of COVID, because they weren't a threat to society, why were they still in prison in the first place? So there, evidence is that there are a lot of people in prison who could be released without any risk to public safety. The most important thing is that the process of starting rehabilitation should begin on the first day that an inmate enters prison and not wait till he's about to get out or she's about to get out to, you know, start thinking about, well, what is this person going to do? I want to tell you just a brief story that happened to me when I was in prison in Oakdale, Louisiana, and there was a black gentleman, Mr. Williams, who was walking toward me from the education trailer, and he stopped and he said, "Governor," he said, "look what they gave me." And I looked at, he had a pile of books under his arm, and he held them out and he said, "Governor, they know I can't read." And that exemplified what was happening at Oakdale. You know, there was an effort to comply with the rules, you know, that, well, let's try to, you know, do something to help these people. But there was, you can't give somebody a stack of books if the person can't read. So we've got to start at day one trying to give people life skills and job skills, or they're not going to be able to make it when they get out.
I agree. It is simple organizational dynamics. I want to keep talking a little bit, if you don't mind, about your experiences. According to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for the American Psychiatric Association, fear is one of three dozen after effects that people can experience as a result of trauma. So how was fear used as a tactic to silence your voice? How did you counteract that to whatever extent possible so that they didn't break you? What kept you going?
Well, I knew who was behind it and why they were doing it. So it was never a mystery to me. I never sat there and thought, "Oh, woe is me. I'm, you know, Lord, why did this happen?" I knew why it had happened and who did it and what their purpose was. You know, I was within just a short span about to announce that I was entering the Democratic primaries for the Democratic nomination for president in 2004, and I was targeted by Karl Rove. It's absolutely clear that his fingerprints are all over my case, and we had testimony from one Republican lawyer that she was on the phone with Karl Rove's partner, the husband of my prosecutor, when he said, "You know, y'all stop worrying about Sittleman. My girls, my wife, the U.S. attorney, is going to take care of him." And that conversation was backed up by a lawyer for the National Republican Party in Alabama, who confirmed that he had been approached and told the same thing, that they were going to use the U.S. attorney to take me out. Out of politics. So I knew what was going on and why. So I didn't succeed at the game of diminishing my spirit.
You're also quite good in karate, aren't you?
I wouldn't say I was quite good. I was, but I am a black belt. I still go to my class at least once a week, and that my karate training actually helped me a great deal. I knew when I was first sentenced and first taken into solitary confinement, you know, they weren't gentle. I mean, it was I was handcuffed, shackled, chained, and around the waist, and sent to a maximum security prison, the oldest one in the country, built in 1895, and put in solitary confinement, and that wasn't the last time I was in solitary confinement. I think I was in for a total of about 150 days during the course of my 5 years in prison. But they still were not able to diminish my spirit. I exercised. I remembered some of my karate training and maintained my strength and my spirit.
frame of reference and the things we bring in are very important to how we survive events. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear the program? Ask them to subscribe for free to their favorite podcast platform to hear all of our programs. I'm your host, Pettis Perry.
Tune in to KSQD this Sunday at 6 p.m. for State of Mind, Being Human and Living Well. After more than a year of online schooling, we look at the impact the pandemic has had on LGBTQ plus teens and how schools and communities are responding. Teen guests courageously share their experiences of coming out, the struggles they've faced, and how they've persevered to find their voices as leaders and advocates. Our guest host for this conversation is Adam Lanfear, a queer community member, recent college graduate, and former State of Mind guest. In honor of Pride Month 2021, come along with us to learn from these remarkable youths about ways to create more supportive environments, hear how small gestures can signal acceptance in a big way, and even help save a life. Join us for new understandings and seeds of possibility on State of Mind, Sunday evening at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org.
Today our topic is Democracy Abandoned, and we're speaking with former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, author of Stealing Our Democracy. You can find it in book form or on Audible. Governor, in our last section here of time, this last segment, I'd like to have you think about what people can do to create more meaningful lives for themselves and as well as more principled lifestyles. But before we get to that, I would like you to talk to a couple of people that I have in mind. I face many of the same discriminatory behaviors that my father faced, and my son has faced many of the discriminatory behaviors as I have. That means we're talking about three generations spanning nearly 125 years, not to mention the rest of my ancestry, in one family whose members are facing the same issues. If you were talking with my son about the things we are facing as a nation today, what would you say to him about our future as a nation?
I would say that, I would tell him what a great dad he has. And
I'm sure
he would agree. And I would, if he would let me, I would sit next to him and engage him in a conversation. And I would want him to tell me how systemic racism, how racism, I want to hear his experiences. I want to hear what he has to say. But the most important thing that I would want to convey is that we can change things. We can make things better. That this rocky ship of state that we find ourselves on, we know that, it's struggling to get back on a moral compass. It's struggling to get its moral compass back and get us in a direction that will move us back toward a real civilized democracy. And I would encourage him to remain strong, to continue with his education and his friends, and to work with them on matters that they find themselves committed to, things that they feel passionate about. Regardless of, this struggle for social change and social justice is not something, unfortunately, that's going to ever end. There's always going to be a struggle. There's always going to be issues that we have to keep fighting to, and I use that word, maybe I should find a better word, but we have to keep working toward making our communities, our states, and our country better. We have to keep working to refine the parameters of our democracy to make sure that we are moving it in the right direction and away from fascism. The main thing I would want to do and leave with your son is a sense of optimism that we can change things, we can make things better. If we work long enough and hard enough, we can make a difference, and we can rest easy at the end of the day knowing that in our lives we have done what we could to improve the lives of others.
Yeah, I think if he was talking with you, he would say, well, Dad, once your generation dies out, we're going to be fine. I have a young friend in Massachusetts who is looking to go into politics when he graduates college. If you were talking with him, what would you say to him?
I would say, do it, number one. I can only go back to my own experience and for my recommendations, and it would be to find a candidate in whom you believe and one that you trust, and work for that candidate and help them get elected. Stay with them, try to help them hold true to the promises that they made during the campaign, and help them accomplish those objectives, because it's important for our democracy that people see that politicians actually do what they promised during the course of the campaign. I would encourage him to enter the political arena himself or herself, to find a district, of course, I ran statewide the first time, and I should have never been elected in Alabama anyway. I mean, I was a flaming liberal. I'd supported Robert Kennedy. I'd worked for Allard Lowenstein, a Jewish member of Congress from Long Island. I worked for the DNC, ran the George McGovern campaign in Alabama. I worked against George Wallace in 1974. When he tried to take over the state Democratic Party. And then I got elected statewide in 1978. So I don't know why I should discourage someone from running statewide, but I would ask that he take a look at the district or the state. He may be able to run statewide, but it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of work, a lot of travel. You've got to go out and meet people. You've got to put together an organization. You've got to have people committed to helping you in every crossroads and community in the district in which you seek to be elected. And then you've got to know what you believe in, but you've also got to find a platform that pulls people in. I was able to be elected ultimately as governor because I wanted to provide free college education and early childhood learning to every child. I believe that every child, regardless of where they're born or to whom, regardless of the color of their skin or the wealth of their family, every child should have the right to reach their God-given potential through education. And I pushed that message and said, we're going to pay for it, not by raising taxes, but by having a state lottery to pay for this. And it was a popular idea, and I was able to beat an incumbent Republican. So, again, pursue your passion. Find a way to bring people into your camp. There are ways to convert people, to let them see that the policies and issues that you're going to fight for are more important than a political party. So, particularly in today's climate, when people are so dug in, we've got to find ways to, bring people. And this is Joe Biden's greatest challenge. He's got to he's got to be able to bring some Republicans in to offset Joe Manchin. He's got to bring in, you know, Mitt Romney and some others and be able to say, hey, you know, we can do this, Joe Manchin, without you. And we're moving forward. We're not going to let you derail my presidency and the wishes of the people of this country. You know, we cannot let some one person do that. So anyway, I would try to be inspirational with this, with the young person who wants to run for office. But I definitely would encourage him to keep working at it, and hard work can make it happen.
I'm going to encourage him to get your book and learn your story, because you have such a powerful story that we should all hear and know about.
Well, Dr. Pettis, tell him to call me. I'd be happy to. In fact, you know, any of your listeners who want to reach out to me can either call me or, you know, text me on at my number. I don't mind you're giving it out, and
okay.
you can give out my Gmail address. It's real simple. It's just G-O-V Sigelman. I couldn't drop the title, so it's govsigelman@gmail.com. But be happy to try to answer questions from any of your listeners.
I really appreciate that, and I'm sure he will take that offer and contact you. You know, we're down to just about a minute. I'm sorry that we don't have more time, because there's so much more I wanted to talk to you about today. But quickly, if you might, what should people keep doing?
We should keep to the streets if there's an issue that moves us. The violence against people of color by police has got to come to an end. We've got to remember that the right to vote is our most precious right, and as Teddy Roosevelt said, the credit belongs to those who are in the arena, whose faces are marred by dust and sweat and blood, who know the great enthusiasms, who spend themselves in a worthy cause. And if they should fail while daring greatly, at least know that their place will not be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. So stay in the arena. Keep fighting for the things that you believe in. Find a candidate that you believe in and trust. Work for them. Help them get elected. And let's change this country and move it back toward the principles to support our democracy.
We've got about 25 seconds. Can you give us a quick stop doing and start doing?
Well, yes, I'd say stop just complaining and start being more active, and both on social media and in person. Show up at rallies and offer support for young people who are, you know, are in the streets and pushing for progressive social change.
Outstanding. I want to thank Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, and our program director, Howard Feldstein, and give a huge thank you to our bold and impressive guest from Alabama, Governor, and I'm going to start calling you friend, Don Siegelman. On Sunday, June 20th, on Be Bold America, will be Freedom and Liberty for All. What does freedom and liberty for all really mean? We'll be speaking with Professor Thomas Main from the School of Public and International Affairs at City University of New York. Thomas Main is also the author of several books, including The Rise of Alt-Right, and his upcoming book, The Rise of Liberalism. So please join me and my co-host, Jill Cody, to discuss what would be the consequences if Americans really lost their freedom. That's Sunday, June 20th at 5 p.m. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for State of Mind with Deborah Sloss, featuring intimate conversations about mental health and wellness here on the Central Coast of California. My name is Dr. Pettis Perry, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time.